Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and on this edition I'm delighted to say we have another author to welcome to the centre circle. But before I introduce our special guest, let me welcome back the usual suspects, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you?
Very well, Stuart. Very well. How are we doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Again, we say this every time we do it, but really looking forward to this one. Should be a good discussion.
Yes, it'll be great.
Excellent. And then obviously, Stephen and I's other compadre, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you?
I'm great too, Stu, buddy. Looking forward to it as well, matey.
Excellent, excellent. So, tonight's special guest is Kevin George, a former professional footballer with West Ham, Charlton and Lincoln City, and who is now a human performance consultant and founder of the Vivo team. Kevin delivers emotional literacy programmes all over the world and sits on many advisory boards and is a member of Kick It Out's Professional Players Guidance Group as well as the PFA. However, tonight we want to talk about his latest book, Sockology. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Kevin George. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm great, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Everything okay with the intro? We covered all the right bits, the right pronunciations?
Yeah, you covered it all.
Oh, excellent. That's okay. That's all right then.
always about.
Yeah. So tonight, those regular sort of Lob podcast listeners will be aware that we sort of have a brief running order. We have some topics that we like to cover, but essentially, the floor is yours, Kevin, and certainly Stephen and Gary will ask you questions. I'll ask you questions. Opinions, that sort of thing, but we're quite happy for you to sort of take the lead and educate us really while we ask questions about the interesting things that you have to say, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Brilliant. So to begin with then, obviously we're going to chat about the book, which is the main reason why we're here, but certainly myself, I'm very, very interested in your playing days as a professional. But obviously, bearing in mind what we're going to talk about later on and what you currently do now, what you learned about yourself and other players during your playing days?
Oh, I've just got to figure out where to start. See, basically, pretty much all the questions you asked me are going to tie back to why I even wrote the book. So what I learned about myself while I was in football, I would say not much. When I came out of football and I reflected on my time in football, I learned a load of stuff about myself. So I learned about how culturally I was held back because I was brought up with the belief of respecting your elders. I was always hearing that as I was older. So I always thought of someone being older than me as my elder, and I never understood the definition. I kind of merged them together. And so anyone that was older than me, and especially an authoritative figure, i.e. a football coach, even when I thought like they'd done wrong by me, I'd always kind of just follow their lead, a bit like a loyal dog in a way. And so what happened was in my time, especially at Charlton, is that I kind of got led down blind alleys. And what I mean by that is I always kind of drew the short straw willingly. So when I came from West Ham, so I was at schoolboys at West Ham, I went to Charlton and played one game. They wanted to sign me and they gave out all their YTS, as they call it now. Well, they call it a scholarship now, but it was a YTS. So I just wanted to be a footballer regardless. So I signed a non-contract. And what you could do is you could make profit on your travel expenses. Like, it's funny, people live 20 minutes from the ground, they was claiming hundreds. And the club kind of indirectly kind of hinted that, you can make your money that way. But what was happening for me was I wanted football so bad that I was pretty much doing whatever I was told, and I believed that I was being told the truth. You know the stuff you get told, football's a team game. If you work hard enough, you'll get an opportunity. I believed all these things, but in fact, they weren't true. So when these things, when they were unfolding as not being true, I never challenge staff. You know when you get some guys, or you hear the stories of this guy was banging on the manager's door? Like, that was never me. But I feel that if that was me, I'd probably be playing in the Premier League right now. And so I had situations where the manager, when we was in the academy, the young pros, you know, we got... I remember one time we was beating Ipswich, I think, in the youth team, like 3-0. Darren Ambrose was playing. I think he scored a hat-trick. So we drew, but it felt like a loss. We got hammered afterwards. And the manager said to us, look... Or, sorry, the director of the academy said, none of you are going in with the reserves except Kevin. And when the reserve team came, 5 players went with the reserves. I didn't go. One of those players was the reserve team manager's son who couldn't get in the youth team. But I had no one fighting my corner. So when I reflected back on my career, I was thinking, like, what was it? Because I wasn't like a shy person or a quiet person. But I realised that actually my cultural beliefs kind of were holding me back in that situation. I kind of saw myself as being rude or disrespectful if I questioned authority. And the agents I had at the time, they were all right. But they only were there to kind of maybe, if I got released, get me a trial. They weren't really there to kind of provide that support or challenge on my behalf. And it's pretty much the same with agents nowadays, where someone like Mina Raiola, whatever his name is, you know, Pogba's agent, yeah. He gets a lot of stick in the press. But the reason why is because clubs can't control him. And I love that. Like, he's basically saying, look, I don't care what you think. I'm going to back my player to the full. That means even if we fall out, I don't care. And I kind of needed that. So in terms of that aspect, I think culturally I learned a lot about myself and how it held me back. I learned that I was kind of a bit of afraid to play because football's full of risks. And I also feel like... I think maybe it's because I was micromanaged. And I think even though it's a sport, I see football as an art. And my manager was micro. He was like a micromanager. He didn't want us to play. He wanted us to kick it long. And I felt like because it's something you express how you feel on a pitch, someone kind of intervened in that process and it made me feel uncomfortable. So I was playing football, but I wasn't loving it. It was almost like a job, you know? So I can go on about it for days, but it was just little things that is mainly upon reflection that I learned about myself. And that led to me writing the book, because what I then did is start to look at my friends who had great careers or didn't have careers and saw that in different ways, their story, although different, was actually linked to mine.
Okay. I mean, Stephen and Gary, you know, straight away, it's fascinating, isn't it? Every time we have someone come on, certainly who's an ex-professional, you know, we have all these, you know, we've had Drew Broughton on, you know, we have all these different perspectives about how players feel when they're actually playing the game. And it, you know, there's this public perception and assumption, isn't it, about what it must be like to be a footballer, and yet you get to speak to them and all of a sudden it's, you know, it's completely different. You know, what do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I think the striking thing for me, and it's becoming more and more of a, you know, a regular theme, is the just how every day a lot of it sounds, you know, and it stands to reason, you know, it is in at the end of the day workplace. So those relationships between, you know, a player and a teammate is exactly the same as you know, a factory worker working with, you know, alongside a, you know, a workmate, or, you know, for a manager, it's your boss, it's your supervisor. You know, those same human demographics will show through in football. And you, it's these little intricacies that I don't think anyone really considers, you know, from the outside looking in as being a fan or an observer of football. And in a way, it's almost vaguely reassuring, you know, watching from a distance that these type of things are, you know, are everyday kind of occurrences for a football player as well as anyone else. You know, there is, I think nowadays we tend to speak ill of that sense of detachment that professional footballers have. You know, we'll, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I'll hark back to a time when, you know, you could watch players walk off bus and get autographs and things like that. And now, you know, as a season ticket holder at Anfield, you know, the bus just drives into this great big huge garage and the shutters come down and there's that cut off. But you know, within that sense of normality is still there, you know. And we'll come to it in a bit, but Mind, Body and Eyes spoke to me with that and but we'll come to that. But like I say, it's just that humanity that speaks through, and Kevin's speaking of it now, and just in exactly the same way that Drew did.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, to hear, you know, Kevin saying about the agents, and it, you know, that bit about, you know, agents seem to get such bad press, and yet here we have, you know, Kevin with us who, you know, really for want of a, you know, like I said, a stronger, more, a bigger personality perhaps of an agent, you know, and his career could have taken a different turn, and it's not something we associate with agents, is it?
No, absolutely not, and I guess, you know, When a young footballer comes into a football club, by definition, they're young and fairly naive. And, you know, some people have bigger personalities than others. But I guess what we tend to forget is, you know, people like yourself and Steve and me and, you know, others at TFT, we watch about football like the people who play the game are some kind of mythical characters. And really, they're just people with the same frailties and concerns and desires as anybody else. And that's why you sometimes forget that... you know, a young footballer starting at a football club is very similar to a young person starting at a factory or an office. And to have somebody who can speak on their behalf, as Kev quite eloquently mentioned about Pogba's agent, you know, he might be disregarded by many as a loudmouth, but that's exactly what somebody needs to speak there, to fight their corner.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, Kevin, it's, you know, you talked about, you know, the culture and, you know, that let you down. That, I'm interested because it's funny, we're talking about chapters and culture is the chapter I'm most interested in, but obviously it's slightly different. But when you talk about culture, is this, you know, you mentioned coaches and seniors, but was also part of that cultural belief of yours, was that also through your family as well?
No, that's where it got passed from. So, yeah, so from at home, that's what I got taught as a young person. But yeah, when you go into the football environment, You're benignly told about hierarchy and how you've got to fit in line or basically you're gone. So it's about basically I'm the coach, you know, you're the player and you're lucky to be here. And if you don't do as you're told, you're gone. And you basically don't really have much say until you're in the first team. But what's the massive problem in football is that the messages are so conflicting because... you know, I've got friends who obviously were players and now coaches, and they say things to me and they say, oh, you know, these youngsters think they've made it. And I say to them, first of all, we have generational blame inside football and outside football. It gets you nowhere. So when I was a kid, as soon as I heard people say, oh, you're a generation, I switched off completely. But I also said to the coaches is that you have to make up your mind on what you want from the young players. Do you want them to behave as pros or not? Because on one hand, the coaches say you need to model yourself on those pros. You need to see what they do, copy what they do. But on the other hand, they say, well, you've not made it yet. Who do you think you are, pro? And so it's so conflicting and it confuses the player. So when they behave like a youngster, they get criticized. But when they try and behave like a pro, they get criticized again because they're big time. And so my thing is I always say, have a consistent message. That's the first problem. I mean, the first point. And also, just kind of pay attention to what your messages are. Because I heard this thing about, you know, for example, you know, players should wear black boots, young players. Now, my thing is this. Everything you do and say should have meaning behind it. If you say players should wear black boots, okay, as a coach, okay, but why? Now, some people say, well, Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, did that at Man United with the youth team. And I always say to coaches, okay, but Sir Alex Ferguson invested in people. So he knew the academy, he knew all the players, he knew their families, he checked in with them, he personalized his approach to each player. Now, are you willing to do all of that? Are you going to take the token parts that are very easy and just pass it off as, well, Sir Alex Ferguson does it, it's good enough for Man United, you've got to do it. And there's this lack of accountability in football. But unfortunately, because no one really knows what they're doing, and it's all conjecture, basically. But people have got away with it. It's the only industry where it's based on experience. You know, like, oh, this guy, he used to play, so he's going to be a manager because he's a former pro. But actually, he was a talented kid who was given a platform to play on TV. What does he know about leadership? So when you look at football and you break it down to all these, to its elements, you realise, actually, what does this person know that I'm a huge fan of or that he's getting paid millions? What do they actually know? And that's why I laugh. I said to one of my friends the other day, I said, think about it. Arsene Wenger came here from Japan, right? So he came to the Premier League, the biggest league in the world. And he got the Arsenal players to reduce their sugar and stop drinking alcohol, and he encouraged them to stretch. And we refer to him now in England as the professor. We laud him. I'm an Arsenal fan. I love Wenger. But when you look at it, there's an extreme level of groupthink in this country that a man could come over, not in the 40s. He came in the late 90s. And to reduce alcohol and encourage professional athletes to stretch, shouldn't we know this already? Do you see what I'm saying here? It's madness.
I mean, obviously, you know, in listening to you and you know, the amount of sort of insight and, you know, that you've picked up into human thinking, you know, it's, I mean, obviously, as you sort of finished, you came to the end of your career, I believe it was Mickey Bennett, was it, head of player welfare at the PFA, who suggested you look at a counselling course. Now, obviously, even sort of 10 minutes in, I can see exactly why. But at the time, you know, having been a professional footballer, what were your reactions to that sort of suggestion post professional football career?
I'm an open-minded person anyway, to be honest with you. I've always kind of, even in my friendship groups, they probably think, oh, that wasn't. Spoke to me about it. I thought, okay, what's this about? And it was at a time when I was very curious because I was kind of bouncing around with ideas of things I can do in my life, but also, because I was probably in a reflective place where looking at how I was in school, looking at how I was in football, I started to realise that actually no one in the world knows what they're doing. So I wanted to know more about it and know more about myself. So when he spoke to me at the counselling course, I thought, oh, do you know what? It's a level one. I'm curious. It's not a big commitment financially or with my time because it was like one evening a week. Let me go and check it out. And then I did it and it blew my mind. I thought, yep, I want more of this. And then I just started to like buy loads of books, do my NLP courses, and obviously go through all the levels of the counselling and the psychotherapy.
Stephen, you know, it's not the sort of traditional career route, is it? Sort of post, you know, we've talked about it before with the old sports shop or a pub, you know, is what used to be the sort of the exit routes for professional footballers.
No, it's not. But again, it's such a great thing though, because it's tapping into kind of like a common sense, you know, thread. You know, it's found a vein in it, and it's hit, you know, it struck oil to so many people. You know, it may, you know, grow from a niche bracket almost. I think Drew referred to it as still being quite a niche kind of route even in today's football. But within that, you can't help but have a receptive audience for it. You know, the people who will, you know, attune to this concept are there to listen, and because they want to, they, you know, it's not like preaching to a classroom of vacant faces who are there because they've been told to, you know. And I think that's the great thing, and that's just one of the striking things for me is again going back to what I said before, in just how human it makes it seem and how everyday it is, you know. And it isn't just a case of, you know, saying these things and it's striking a chord to a football. It a lot of it strikes a chord to a human being, regardless of what route they take through their lives.
I suppose, you know, it's great to hear sort of how you got to where you are, Kevin. But obviously, you know, part of it's the book. Now, the book, you know, obviously we've all read, and I it was two sittings for me. Once I started, that was it. I was absolutely absorbed, and certainly it's full of direct quotes from, you know, from footballers, which, you know, which absolutely fascinating. And, you know, Gary mentioned earlier, you know, we write about football and footballers, these mythical characters, and for me personally, it whenever I hear a footballer speak, it still brings out the child in me. I'm desperate to hear what they have to say and what they have to think, even now, and all of them are younger than me. So the book, I mean, you know, to sort of, you know, for everyone who's listening, if you can just sort of, you know, introduce and overview your book for us, please.
Okay, the book is The Psycho and Emotional Elements of Football, and it's for pretty much anyone who loves football, anyone who has a career at any stage of the game, because it takes you literally into the personal ethnography of people who work in the game, whether it be a player, you've got a parent, a coach, manager, and you've even got professionals outside, but they're talking about the things that people are experiencing or the roles that you take up in the game. And I personally felt that there was nothing there to educate me or support me as a player or, as I said, any role in the game. So I created this book where you got access to people not only across generations, but also across the world, giving you their experience.
I mean, Gary, you know, we sort of chatted, haven't we, before about, you know, sort of chapters and, you know, what caught our eye and so on. But, I mean, you know, the book is, like I said, it is for anybody with a love of football, isn't it?
Well, I think rather than for anybody with a love of football, it's for everybody with a love of football. And it's a massive thanks to Kevin and people like Kevin who have sort of lifted the lid on aspects of football that people outside the game, such as the three of us talking here with Kevin, wouldn't know otherwise. And you know, it's opening the reality of the game to us, as it's populated by people, and it's really difficult sometimes to grasp that you know, the guys who play this game at whatever level we're talking, and we, you know, there could be world stars, there could be people playing non-league football, there could be people playing Sunday league football. But they're just people come the end of the day, and they have this, I said earlier, they have the same sort of concerns that we have, and aspirations and hopes and fears. And you know, it's massive credit to Kevin. And as Steve mentioned earlier, the book is eminently readable about a massively potentially complicated subject. So for anybody and everybody who's interested in football, this is a must-read book.
I mean, Kevin, you know, there's a lot, like I said before, there's a lot of direct quotes from players. You know, you've spoken to a lot of players with regards to research in this book. How forthcoming were they in regards to sharing, you know, their thoughts with you, and then obviously what you were intending to do with, you know, with those thoughts? Because there's a lot of trust involved, I assume, with, you know, with players, with some of the things that were shared with you.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's so interesting because I put pressure on myself because I thought, they're giving me their biography here and stories they've never shared before, and I need to make sure that this comes across in the right way, because, you know, they're trusting me. But it's so interesting because when speaking to them, they never kind of said, oh, you know what, make sure you do this, don't do that. I kind of put that on myself. They were actually okay with stepping forward. I felt the only kind of block I would say there was, and this is probably worse because they're footballers, because you've got to kind of protect yourself, because you know what it's like, the press or people always trying to get little stories on you. But I feel like they're kind of detaching themselves. So the players were open, but I was trying to get to their heart, and it was like I was getting surface level comments at first. And my thing is, I didn't want this to be like a newspaper or Sky Sports interview. I wanted someone to get that book and really feel what that player is going through. And it's not necessarily talk about mental health, but also getting to know the process behind the levels of intelligence to execute on certain parts of the game. So I found that certain times, the first couple conversations I had, I was like, oh, I wasn't really happy with how it went. And I was trying to then look at ways that I can have, it's almost like I had a newfound respect for you know, people who do interviews, because we can, okay, there's a skill to this. How do I have this conversation that not only makes them feel comfortable, but actually strategic to kind of touch on certain topics? So that was a bit of a challenge. But in terms of the players, they were fine in stepping forward. And I was quite lucky because of my personal relationships. Like, you know, obviously you read Moses Ashokodi's story, but it was so funny because when I spoke to him, he was like, all right, Kev. And he just went into it. I was like, wow. And I know Moses. I've known him for years, but I never knew his story. And obviously, for people who are listening, you just got to buy the book. I'm going to go into it. But I just thought, bloody hell. And the thing is, after that, I had people approach me, podcasts and like some on some YouTube people, and they wanted to get hold of him to do, you know, interviews. And he said, I don't feel comfortable. He goes, he did it for me, but he's not speaking on no other channel. So it was nice to know that they felt comfortable enough to speak with me about it.
I mean, you know, absolutely. It's funny because I was just about to ask with regards, you know, your interviews with the players. Were they, you know, were they one-on-one, just you and the player, and or was there a, you know, another president? You know, we talked about agents and club advisors and club welfare officers, but was it very much a one-on-one sort of discussion between you and the other players?
Yeah. But mainly not is in terms of being present over the phone. So
okay.
because of timetables, and you have to remember, like, Gail Clichy's playing in Turkey. Stephen Moore still lives in Birmingham. You know, you've got players all over the world. So it was mainly over Skype and on the phone, really.
Okay. But like you say, I mean, you know, it's a massive trust issue, isn't it? You know, you're the one that they've trusted to tell their story, essentially, and you have to, like you say, you have to do it justice or make sure that it, you know, the finished product is how they would want to read it as well, without actually being guided by them and put this and don't put this. Like you say, it is a massive trust issue, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's so funny because I was doing loads of press and I kind of ended up merging Gail Clichy's contribution and Fabian Delph's contribution. So Fabian Delph eats clean, he does meditation, and Gail Clichy is a vegan and he does yoga nidra, which is a movement of meditation. So as I'm doing my interviews, I accidentally merged the two and I ended up saying that Fabian Delph's a vegan. And I was like, oh my God. And then he started getting all these messages and DMs on Instagram and about him being a vegan, and I was like, oh man, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And he was like, oh, don't worry about it, because obviously the press run with it. But he's like, you know what, Kev, because I've not even read a newspaper for like 3 years anyway, or 6 years, so he wasn't that bothered.
I mean, yeah. It's funny. Obviously, the next thing, you know, I wanted to chat about, and again, I know I keep going on this, but Steve and Gary and I talk, you know, quite a lot via the pod and, you know, and outside the pod as well. And it seems at the, you know, there seems to be a real culture shift at the moment. You know, maybe it started with Wenger, maybe it started with the influx of foreign players, but this sort of traditional macho culture that very much sort of permeated and dominated English football, you know, now all of a sudden we have this, you know, this awareness more of, you know, of a player's mental health. And, you know, I'm interested, especially you, Kevin, you know, do you think society has become more accepting, or do you think football has become more accepting?
Oh, I'm trying to think of where to start with this. Society, yes, I think they've been forced to accept it, the conversation. You know what? I saw. Have any of you guys seen Concussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, the film, the American football.
Yes.
Yeah, the Pittsburgh
Steelers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, obviously, with Concussion, you've got the problems that were happening to the NFL players, right? And they kept trying to sweep it under the carpet until it started to affect people within the organization, and it got too big in the media. I feel like with mental health, these problems have been going on for a very long time, but because more celebrities, you had Gary Speed in football take his own life, you have people in all sorts of on all sorts of platforms now either being affected or talking about it, we kind of have to face it. But the problem we have, and this is probably why I'm going to do a book on this, but the problem we have with mental health is that, or should I say, like, even around the whole machoism, and I kind of link it to mental health, funnily enough, is that, one, in society, we've just got a miseducation around the topic. So there was no conversation about it. Now it's a miseducation because we only refer to it as illness. And then secondly, linking back to being a man, what it is to be male, I was always brought up on this whole alpha in terms of being macho, getting loads of girls, being aggressive. And so when it comes to sport, you've got to throw on top of that now, being a group of men and seeking weakness in the opposition. And that means if you're seeking the weakness in opposition, it naturally kind of reflects that you can't show any weakness. That means not only to your opponent, but within your team, because then you'll be seen as a weak link. Now, if I'm going through anything, you know, it could be some extreme low feelings, depression, it could be low-level anxiety. I can't express that. So that means I'm going to be holding it. What's that going to do to me? You know, so for me, it's like, when I look at it, the game's moving in the right direction, because naturally in society we're moving in the right direction, but I still feel that we are at an extreme low position right now. And it's quite interesting, actually, because the reason why I noticed the game change is when I was watching Match of the Day and I was looking at some of the centre-backs, I was thinking, wow, when I was coming through, centre-backs had to wear, you know, they kind of, it's like this social law where they all wore black boots and they literally, it's almost like they deliberately didn't take care of themselves because they wanted to look rough. If they did, then they were kind of excluded because you're a centre-back. You're supposed to be ugly and nasty. But now I look at, say, like the John Stones, the Otamendis and the David Luizes, and it's so interesting how things have changed. But the thing is, you can't hang on to those beliefs and say, oh, I want my defenders a certain way, because the game's evolved. And when you look at the centre-backs nowadays, they give so much more to the game. Obviously, the game's changed, but you wouldn't survive being a Tony Adams nowadays. You just wouldn't. The clubs wouldn't even take you seriously because you don't have enough to your game. So it's, you know, it's changed.
It's funny. I mean, again, you know, we talk about this all the time, don't we, Stephen and Gary? I mean, you know, Stephen, you know, we've looked at how, well, we've talked about how sometimes football reflects society and society mirrors football and so on. And, you know, what Kevin says there about the, even just the metaphor of the changing image of a centre-back, you know, almost sums up perfectly how the game is changing and the aspects within the game as well, isn't it?
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, about wanting to name names, a certain centre-back sprung to mind as soon as Kevin did that that identikit of the stereotypical centre-back. But yeah, I found it interesting there was when Kevin was talking about, you know, external influences, you know, having an effect on playing, you know, if there was a low level of anxiety or a depression, and how it would be able to take that onto the pitch, because obviously it goes onto the pitch with a player because it's part of the player, it's part of the mind. The mind goes onto the pitch as well as the body does. The interesting thing I found with Drew, when Drew was talking about similar topics and similar themes, was that Drew kind of assessed himself as having been a character football player. He didn't play the role of himself. He played to, he almost acted his football career out. And that his take on it was that there were maybe 20, 25 games out of 650 or whatever it was he played where he felt like himself and he hit, you know, he just hit it out of the park almost. You know, he felt great going onto the pitch and it was going to be perfect. I mean, Kevin, did you feel that you played your career, you know, as a character, or did you play as yourself?
No, I was as myself. I always was, but I would say, actually, how can I say this? I was myself, but I would say I was partially myself. And what I mean by that is I wasn't playing a role, but because I felt anxious when I was playing, I wasn't my whole self. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I say, like, I mean,
an element in, but yeah.
Football is role play, though, isn't it? Really, like, you can look at Roy Keane. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
That's right. No, go.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, if you look at someone like Roy Keane, we kind of built him up as a leader. Like, you know, people were kind of bringing him back up with this whole Pogba situation that happened before Christmas, and it was like, you know, leaders like Roy Keane, and in my head, I thought, but, you know, first of all, it's got nothing to do with this now, but it made me really think about Roy Keane. He was just like aggressive and angry leader on the pitch. And then I thought, well, who are you? Because how can you be so extreme? Then who are you at home? Who are you when you're in the change room? Who are you in these different places? So I started to look at some interviews. And I saw an interview with Darren Fletcher saying that actually he was one of the funniest guys in the change room and he was actually quite considerate. So it makes you think, like, actually, these are just role plays. Players are caricatures of, probably, I wouldn't say themselves, but who they think they should be.
Yeah, they find some kind of part of their psyche, don't they? And then they utilise that. That's the, you know, the picture I get, is that they find something within and run with that. And it's not representative of them as a person as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always been this, no matter what environment I am in, I'm always myself. So I definitely wouldn't say I was a caricature of anything when I played. I was just who I am, to be honest with you.
Right.
I mean, you know, Gary, I don't mean to bring age up. I am really sorry, and it seems to happen every time we do this. And I am sorry. But, you know, between, you know, sort of between the four of us, I mean, obviously you've seen the biggest shift, if you like, in terms of culture, you know, the culture within football, but certainly this culture of, you know, the macho, the traditional sort of English type of game, English type of player, compared to where we are now. You know what I mean? You know what, I suppose before we just move on to the next bit, you know, your sort of thoughts in terms of, you know, the impact that that seems to have had on the game itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, my formative years of football go back to the 1960s, and certainly it was a different world then in so many ways. But sort of moving forward, picking up on the particular topic that you've mentioned there, the macho aspect of football has been very much diluted now. And certain people such as Arsene Wenger, and perhaps also the influx of foreign players into the English game has sort of helped to move that change along, and so much better for it as well, because it releases people from the stereotypes that some people think they have to perform at, and gives them the ability to be the people they are and play the game that they can play. So it is a massive change, and as I say, it's change for the better, because we stop locking people into boxes that they don't fit in necessarily. So I think it's a massive change, and it's a massive advantage, and a good thing too.
I mean, within the book, Kevin, I think there's 10 chapters within there, and I sort of, you know, spoke to, you know, while we were sort of preparing for this, and I sort of spoke to Stephen and Gary and sort of asked them for their sort of particular favourite chapter, most interesting, how, you know, however they wanted to, you know, define it and talk about it a little bit more. But before I come to those two, was there a chapter within your book that was almost a starting point with the idea, or did the chapters just seem to link one after the other after the other? I'm just sort of interested in your thought process as to how you put those together.
There was no particular chapter, if I'm being honest, because how I started, I started making notes in probably like 2010, and I didn't know where I wanted to go with it, but I was just very curious as to there being more to the game of football. So I started to make notes on anything that spoke about the person. So 2011, I kind of started to up my game again with the notes, and I said to myself, I'm going to write a book. But I wasn't really serious. And then by the time I hit December 2017, I had a meeting. I was going to do work in Wandsworth Prison. I had a meeting with this lady who'd written a book. And I said to myself, this is it, I've got to do it, because I was frustrated with myself that I've not done it. So I literally had this a folder on my laptop with notes, like, spanning across all these years. And it was like walking into a messy room with your wardrobe everywhere, you're trying to pick out an outfit. So I was like, okay, how can I make sense of this? How can I put these into chapters? And so I made so many chapters, I probably could have done another book, but I thought, no, I need to make this concise, I need to make sure that the reader stays on point in terms of what the topic is, and keeps them interested and takes them into the hearts and minds of the player. So it wasn't like specific chapters or one that I started off on. It was me kind of cleaning up my room, really.
so that's fair enough. You know, Stephen, I'll come to you first then, in terms of, you know, areas within the book, you know, what sort of caught your attention?
Oh, I mean, I love the chapter Mind, Body and Eyes. You know, there was a lot in there that that really piqued my interest, you know, down to whether that's Timo Werner, you know, putting in his earplugs at Besiktas to blot out the noise. You know, it's just little bits like that that just, again, humanise the game. You know, we talk about how, or often talk about how detached footballers are from the public, but there you are, it's kind of like external events are affecting a player on the pitch that, you know, and I don't think we always realise that happens, or we take it for granted that it doesn't, or we don't appreciate that it does, I think. But I think further into the book, I think the bit about into the chapter was the talk about Claude McAlally his massive importance to Real Madrid. Again, for me, it came down to, it illuminates the core intelligence. And again, hark back to the podcast with Drew, and we spoke about a certain type of intelligence within a player. And I've often spoke to kind of like academics and teachers and that concept of being learned, as in, you know, a school or a college or a university environment, doesn't give you a guarantee of just a basic core intelligence, of having that third eye aspect of seeing the bigger picture, to see a panoramic view of your, you know, your surroundings, of where you are and what's happening. And I found it interesting the description of how Makélélé could see how the opposition was playing as much as he could, his own team. But I can remember, and I can't remember where I read it, but there was an interview one time about Del Bosque's time at Real Madrid in charge as the coach, and he'd spoken so highly of Makélélé and McManama, and it was not all down to what they did on the pitch. It was what they brought of a wider span across the squad, is that they held the community together. They brought humour when it was needed. They brought common sense when it was needed. And it was that core, basic, broad intelligence. The interesting thing for me is that when both of them left the same summer, 2003, you can chart just how dramatically Real Madrid fall away from the high standards that they had under Del Bosque. And it's that striking core intelligence that spoke to me there.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, every chapter seems to bring something new to, certainly to myself, you know, as a reader as well, and obviously having never played the game as well. Gary, you know, what about yourself in terms of, you know, attracting your attention?
Well, for me, the standout chapter was leadership, and probably because of my circumstances and my sort of work career, I was a manager from when I was 23 till I got my briefcase when I was sort of 60. So I've had that sort of leadership thing in me, and I've always said that people say to me, you know, you're a business manager. Well, no, you don't manage business. You manage people, because the business is only the people, or it's a bit of machinery, or it's a desk and it's a pen. Well, I don't do anything without the people. It's all about managing people. And I think the chapter that Kevin put together there really emphasised that particularly well. And he's got a quote in there from Chris Powell that says, "Football isn't about managing people. About managing players, it's about managing people." And absolutely, it chimed with me perfectly. And it's all about knowing different individuals who are working for you, and what works for you, what works for them, and what buttons to press to get the best from the people that you're employing. And Quinton Fortune's got a piece in there mentioned about Sir Alex Ferguson, about how he knew different individuals and what worked for them. And Kevin mentioned earlier about how Ferguson was brilliant about knowing about players' background, their families, and somebody's birth. As I remember a press conference, I think it was Johnny Evans, I might be wrong, and he mentioned something about Johnny Evans being married or something like that, and he actually wasn't. His fiance or girlfriend was in the press ensemble, and he said, "Well, you want to marry her?" Now, I mean, I know that's a bit sort of, I know it's a bit weird, but you know, but it got that sort of family patriarchal care about it, and it's something that probably that the players may appreciate. And also, it mentions about Mourinho. I was sorry, but I really enjoyed this chapter. It really spoke to me. And I remember when Mourinho first went to Chelsea, and he'd just been appointed to the manager's chair, and there was an England camp at the time, and Mourinho went to the England camp. I'm not sure where he was. It wouldn't have been in Burton, because it was before that time, to see Frank Lampard. And he went to Lampard, and Lampard had just come out of a training session, coming out of a shower, he was getting changed, and Mourinho says to him, "I'm going to make you the best midfielder in the world." Now, it's arguably whether he achieved that or not, but Lampard, and I think it was in his autobiography, he mentions this, says that, you know, it made him feel 10 feet tall. And this is all about inspiring people, knowing what works with people, what doesn't work with people, what to say, and also perhaps what not to say. And there's also a piece in there about Barca and Cruyff, and how Cruyff changed the whole mentality of Barcelona and had the ability to do that through his leadership qualities, but not only by sort of going in there and shouting and screaming at players, but by proving his point and showing how things would be successful. Milan is also mentioned there. And I remember I wrote a piece for the Calcio magazine, the TFT magazine, the Calcio magazine, about Sarchi and his time at Milan. And when he got the job there, the press derided him massively by saying, you know, you never played football at this level, how can you take over a team like Milan? And he said, well, you know, you don't have to be a horse to be a successful jockey. And that sort of thing, you know, he had that leadership ability. And it's all that, it's knowing how to manage people. It's knowing how to, you don't have to be, and Kevin mentioned earlier about players, managers who were ex-players. It doesn't necessarily give them that managerial ability. You know, you could be a great painter, but you're not a good art teacher necessarily. And leadership skills are almost an indefinable quality, and you need to understand it. And I was quite fortunate. I didn't sort of go from university to a management position. I started my first job as a weighbridge clerk at a quarry, weighing lorries in and out. And in 18 years, I progressed from being that weighbridge clerk to being managing director of the company. I came up the hard way, and I understood how people reacted to different circumstances, and how people were different in so many variable ways. And I think that's the quality that Kevin is trying to. I hope I'm going to ask exactly if he's right. I'm hoping that's the kind of quality he was trying to talk about in that chapter. Is that right, Kevin?
Oh yeah, no, that's what I was trying to get across. So it was about humanising the player, and there were so many other things, because I'm a massive fan of football. It was one is trying to say, look, these guys are still human. But because the press always will say, for example, you know, you're not Wayne Rooney, you're 300 grand a week Wayne Rooney. So you're always kind of unconsciously installing the wage in the mind of someone. So then what naturally people will think is almost like, it's like you put petrol in a car, it drives. I put money in this player, he doesn't feel. Just before. Yeah. And so what I was trying to do is kind of reverse that bit. And actually, when it comes to leadership, you know, this is one of the reasons why I stopped playing football. So when I fell out of love with the game, because everything I thought it was, it wasn't. And I was playing non-league, and I never forget, I went into the changing room, and at halftime we were losing, and the manager started just effing and blinding. And I sat there, and I thought to myself, we're going to go out in the second half, and he's not said anything. He's just swore. There's no plan. There's no kind of information about why we're losing. There was nothing. And I thought, why am I even doing this? But when I think about it, this wasn't just because it's a non-league. This was the professional game. So I thought, okay, so these are all little things that actually link to why I did the book. But when I look at leadership in the game, and when I look at when I was at Charlton, this was in the Premier League, I can't tell anyone what I learned. I didn't really learn anything. Like, that's worrying, you know, because you're playing in a professional institution, the biggest league in the world, and I can turn around and say I didn't learn anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's madness. So... Yeah. I'm not sure
if it's in that same chapter or it's another chapter, but you mentioned about how football clubs lay out massive amounts of money on these assets and then don't seem to have the wherewithal to make them work effectively. And the closing part of the chapter, the leadership chapter, you mentioned how managers should be like farmers. I can't remember who the guy, you're quoting some guy, and how to grow and nurture players as people to get the best out of them. You know, if you put a seed in the ground and swear at it, it's not going to do a great deal of good. But if you nurture it, treat it well, and help it to grow, then it's going to prosper, and you're going to prosper as well.
Yeah, I mean, Sir Ken Robinson, he always refers to agriculture, and I love his metaphor. So I always refer to agriculture when I speak about people. So that comes from him, and it's always the case. But unfortunately, because in football, you've got people in football and you've got people outside of football. It's almost like two separate worlds. So when the people who invest in football, they kind of think, okay, I don't know about it, I'm going to entrust those in football. But those in football have been brought up on those that came before them who don't really know much about people. So it's been allowed to continue. But this is why we struggle at the moment in England in terms of managers getting jobs, because we're not going the extra mile. So people like, say, Wenger and Mourinho, they weren't top players. So the good thing about that for them was that they were forced to look at the game from different angles. Now, if you were someone who did play in the game, you might be blinded by your experience. You've been given everything. People kind of respect you because you achieve so much as a player. But then it kind of, you know, you can end up sinking. You get a job, you actually don't really know the different ways to look at. For example, if I'm a centre midfielder and I'm struggling with strategies or something else, because you've been so good at it, you won't know how to pass your learning. You don't know other ways to look at that problem and pass the learning on to me. And this is, I only know this is a rumour, but apparently this is where Glenn Hoddle kind of struggled, because when he had the England team, he couldn't understand why guys struggled technically with certain issues. And that's why. So Mourinho, he's kind of killed me a bit, because obviously in the book, you know, he's got these things where he values human science, and I feel that since his second, you know, time at Chelsea, he's kind of imploded, and obviously at Man United. But if we kind of just for now pretend those two things didn't happen, he valued the human science. He was big on NLP, and he's influenced the people that worked under him so that they're doing life coaching courses, doing all these things because he valued that. Arsene Wenger, not so much so, actually. I kind of heard the opposite with Wenger. But then saying that, he does have, players do form an attachment to him. So I always say we've got to look at the best and look at what it is in detail. Let's not just look at the surface. If I'm a coach or a manager and I'm serious, I need to look at what is Wenger's code. What is his behavioural code? I need to know how he breathes. All right. Now, what can I take from him? What can I take from Pep? To be honest with you, Pep's probably the most difficult because he came up under a football activist in Cruyff. And he was brought up, it's almost like being brought up in that house. Because, you know, obviously he was there as a player under him. Then Cruyff was a consultant at Barca. Then Cruyff was his mentor. So personally, he had that. And so it's almost like Pep probably doesn't even know to the level of his knowledge and passion. It's probably just overpowering. I would like to see if we get a better manager than him. Because Sir Alex done it over a great time. But I think what Pep's done in terms of the style of play and how he's revolutionised football, I don't think we'll get a better one. I'd be very surprised.
Yeah, that's a good point you make there. And I'll just throw in as well, Alex Ferguson, with regard to, you know, not an exceptional player. I mean, you know, OK, professional, but he played with Rangers for a while, I think, but hardly a world-beating player. And sometimes, you know, you need to have gone through that work it out situation to be able to teach players how to progress as well. I remember reading a piece about Zola when he was at West Ham, and it's not dissimilar to what you were mentioning about Glenn Hoddle. And one of the West Ham players said, you know, oh, in training, Zola's still the best player on the pitch. Well, I mean, that's fine, and you know, I'm a Chelsea fan, I'm a great Zola fan. But, you know, that shouldn't necessarily be the case. He shouldn't be displaying his talents. He should be teaching other players to display those talents. And perhaps because he got that natural ability, he'd never had to cross the bridge of learning how to develop talent of his own and therefore with others as well.
Yeah, but it goes both ways. Because I remember in the academy at Charlton, we had managers who, one of them was like a former school teacher, the director. And the others couldn't really give examples. They would talk to us about football, but they just, you know, one was out of shape and all of this. But then when we had Mark Robson, who was an unbelievable player, he would join in training and literally embarrass players. But he could also do demos. But that was motivating because he was telling us what to do and showing us. And we were seeing the benefits you could get. So it goes both ways. You know, it's like being a teacher. There's you've got a group of people, and it's going to work for some, and some things won't work for others. And your job is to try and almost the ones who fall behind, prop them up in different ways. So,
Yeah, fair comment, buddy.
But I was going to say, in general, my thing as a football lover is looking at the things I love and why. I find it interesting that we've got the greatest players in the world, and no one knows why. You know, I asked Gareth Southgate on Twitter years ago before he got this role, what made our Brazilian Ronaldo, R9, the greatest striker? And he said, quick scores goals and strong and a few other things. But if you take those elements and you had them lined up and you kind of looked at all the players who possessed those elements there, you have loads of players. None of them near to Ronaldo. So it's like, what is it? Like, what are the idiosyncrasies of that person that makes him do that? That's what I want to know. But what? Yeah. And I feel that at the moment in football, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and we don't dig deep enough. I want to know, like, what was Ronaldo doing? Now, me personally, I looked at it as a fan on YouTube, so I can't really say how credible this is. But one thing I noticed with Ronaldo is that he had the perfect run. Take away his skills and all the other obvious stuff, right? But if you look at his running pattern, he's got a perfect running pattern in terms of I kind of married a picture of him and a picture of Usain Bolt together. Perfect. But when he's in a busy environment, he drops only a little bit of speed, but he changes his running pattern. And I thought, this is brilliant, because usually players kind of do this jockey to kind of slow you down and then explode away. Something Cristiano Ronaldo would do. So he'll kind of do a little like bounce and explode, because he's sharper than you, he's quicker than you, he's gone. But Ronaldo will continue, R9 will continue running, but he would change his running pattern. So this is key, because what he was doing was he wouldn't lift his knees up as high. So his foot, let's say his feet would probably go 15 centimeters off the ground instead of 30 centimeters off the ground, right? Now, because of this and his high level of skill, that even if you twitch in his direction, he can shift the ball somewhere else. And I think those are the little details that we miss that can say, do you know what? That's what makes this guy world class. And actually, because we know that, we can replicate it, not with everyone, but actually we can teach that, we can coach that. And maybe not only a player might be able to be another version of Ronaldo, but they can be another version of something else because of and acknowledge the importance of those small details.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you raised there. I just wonder, you know, if we had the chance to sit Ronaldo down and ask him that question, whether he would say that was a conscious thing or whether it was something that just became natural to him. But in either instance, it doesn't mean you can't sort of notice and pass it on to others. But that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, it's being studious, isn't it? It's being a student of the game almost, isn't it? You know, it's like I remember the story about Kaká, you know, studying the way that the Lyon version of Janino took those epic free kicks that he used to hit on such a regular basis, and he pored over image after image and videos of it and YouTube, and he tried to, you know, he tracked him down, and he would watch over and over and over again, you know, how he hit the ball, and you know what part of the foot where the weight was, and that's just a, you know, a stunning piece of football study. You know, it's remarkable to watch unfold.
It's funny. I mean, sorry. No, that's right. I mean, obviously we could, you know, we could talk all night, but now we are into, you know, sort of the interesting areas. And it's funny, you know, listening to what you've all, you know, all just said there. I mean, I suppose sort of that, you know, the last thing, Kevin, you know, for me is, how, you know, you talked about how we can teach this and how we can re-educate footballers, and I'm wondering how this book, how your text, how this holistic approach at educating footballers and, you know, football intelligence, emotional intelligence, you know, it seems to me that really, you know, it's at the academies where this needs to be brought in. It's almost, you know, it should be sort of core reading, if you like, you know, at academy level. How, you know, have the academies embraced, you know, what it is you're trying to say in the book?
Yes and no. So they have, but I mean, I always compare football to the educational system. It's like, if you're in the academy, you've got so much paperwork as part of the ECCC. You've got restraints from above because of where they see value, what they want done. So there's so much pressure that you can't focus on other things that are seen as extracurricular. You've got to focus on what, you know, you're kind of in a quote-unquote being graded on now. So I know that they value it because I, you know, they've got me in the past, and also because I speak to the coaches now and they're like, we need to get you in. But they don't. But they But the thing is that they don't need, it's not as if I'm cold calling or whatever. They reach out to me. So I know they see the value in it and they want to, but they just, they, you know, their hands are tied. And also, as I always say to people, with football, professional football, a lot of people don't know what they're doing on a deeper level. They do their coaching badges, they go in. So it's one thing wanting something, but you can't really fight for something you don't really understand. You know, so if, for example, it was me and I'm saying to my coach or my academy director or the gaffer, we need to get this guy in. And then he says, why? You know, because, and people kind of say, oh, it's mental health in football. Like, they don't really understand. So that's kind of why I need to come in, but they can't explain why I need to come in because they don't really get it. But what I'm saying touches them because they've either played the game and they've experienced it. You know, that it just goes in loops. So that's where we are.
Do they have? Has there been any sort of response from the FA or the PFA in terms of, you know, sort of their support for this?
Do you know, I'll be honest with you. The PFA, I had Osher Williams, who's the, I forgot his role. He's a, I think he's like the deputy director of education, and he came to my book launch, and he absolutely loved it. In fact, which copy of Psychology did you guys have? Was it the white or the blue?
White.
Okay, so that was my self-published version. Because it's now published, Osher's got a quote on there. And when he, after the book launch, he absolutely loved it, that he got it put on the PFA website as well. So I pretty much get on with all the guys at the PFA anyway. So they support it. But one of the things is that a lot of people just don't read. So I know a few people in the PFA have actually had the book. One person I know in the FA has got it. But people don't read. So it sounds interesting, but that's where we are. So what I'm in the process of doing, funnily enough, I've got to watch some documentaries tonight. A film director I know has sent me some because I'm planning to make a documentary because, you know, unfortunately, people just don't read and that's just where we are. And but I know that the players have loved it. Gael Clichy, he, before he even read it, he was like, oh, my God, this is amazing, because obviously he only knew about his quote.
Yeah.
And he posted it on his Instagram and... I mean, there's loads of players who are just saying, oh, this is amazing. Like, they absolutely, they're over the moon. And for me, that's the biggest thing, because not only did they trust me with their stories and they're happy, not just in terms of how I represented them, but how I represented the game and, you know, players in general, but also it's because a part of me thinking, okay, I was so confident in the product, but it's, you know, sometimes you've got to check out with someone as well. So I'm happy that I've represented them in a good way and actually they see the value in it.
That's brilliant. I mean, you know, like, it's almost like we've come, you know, we've come full circle. You know, we started off, you know, asking about how, you know, how the players felt, you know, trusting you and what a big responsibility is. And, you know, and we've come right back to the, to that very point again. And having talked about the book and, you know, how the players appreciate the book and appreciate what you've done. I mean, unfortunately, time is against us. I mean, you teased us a little bit with the fact that you're writing a second book. Again, we would love for you to, you know, to come back on and, you know, and chat with us or chat with us about the documentary, you know, if you're willing to, you know, sort of spend some more time with Gary, Stephen and I.
Sure.
You know, it's been absolutely fascinating. Certainly, you know, for the listeners, you know, myself, certainly I absolutely implore you to, you know, to buy a copy of Kevin's book, you know, Psychology. It is absolutely fascinating. And like Gary said, you know, for anybody who has a love of football, you will be able to get something from this book. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your time and certainly your expertise. You know, it's been an hour, but it seems like it's just flown by. You know, it's been absolutely fascinating to listen to you.
Pleasure.
Excellent. Stephen, once again, thank you very much for insight and contributions.
A joy as ever, and that's been a great hour.
Excellent. Gary, joining us from Spain, you know, it's great, aren't they? We're so lucky, you know, with the people that we're starting to get on here now. You know, every day is a school day, as they say. We're just learning more and more.
Oh, yeah, it's like games day at the end of school term. It's brilliant. Kevin, you've been wonderful for us there, Kevin. Thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's been a real pleasure. The book's fantastic, Kevin, so thank you for writing that, and thanks for sharing it with us and the insights that you've given us tonight, mate.
That's cool. I'm glad you enjoyed it. As I said, it was good to get the feedback. So glad you enjoyed it, and... you can actually do me a favour. You can leave a review on Amazon, even though I know you probably got it from Joe. You can still leave one anyway. So if you liked it, write a review. That would be great.
It'll be done, sir.
And the other good thing for you as well is I've actually ordered a copy at the university where I teach. I put it on the core reading list for the second year for the new programme. So you can have that for free.
What are you doing?
Once I'd read it, I was like, we need this.
What course is it for at the uni?
It's myself and another colleague. We've written a foundation degree on football coaching. We've looked at things like, you know, the four-corner model, the DNA, the EPP, you know, all the things that we mentioned, you know, looked at coaching, you know, certainly with, you know, through the foundation phase, youth development phase. And, you know, we were looking for a text that sort of encapsulated everything that needs considering with regards to players and player welfare, and not just the physical, not just the mental, but, you know, but looks at just about everything. And so, yeah, I've read that, and my friend John, I was like, John, I found it. I found the book. I found what we need. You know, we'll order it. So, yeah, copies are being ordered for the library.
It's funny. I'm supposed to be doing some work at UCFB. They've actually ordered some as well. But what I will say is, when you see the new version, you might be upset, because that new version looks amazing. It's because obviously the one you guys have got is one I just done myself.
Yeah.
The publisher's done this new one. So you've got like this new sleeve, and that it's amazing.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, it's brilliant. You know, it is absolutely brilliant. And, you know, I can only reiterate what the guys have already said. You know, thank you so much for your time and your insight. It's, you know, it's been brilliant.
Pleasure.
So this has been the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. All that's left me to say is, you know, thank you very much for listening, and please be sure to join us again next time. Thank you.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.